This is The Sporting Life on ESPN Radio and the ESPN app. Here's Jeremy Schapp.
Lou Gehrig, the Iron Horse, is one of the essential figures in American sports. And now there is a new book that is an essential addition to his story. At least those are the words I used in a blurb for this new book. It's Lou Gehrig's Lost Memoir, with a biographical essay by the man who joins us now. He's also the editor of this volume, Alan D. Gaff. Alan, thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Jeremy. It's great to be with you.
Well, as I said, and I'm going to quote myself again, which I am wont to do. It's a despicable habit, but nevertheless, I said in the blurb, "Lost No More, Lou Gehrig, The Lost Memoir is a remarkable find and brings the Iron Horse to life in a new, compelling way." I have to say, when I was made aware of the existence of this so-called lost memoir, I was surprised, and I suspect you might have been as well, Alan.
Totally. I was working on another project when I just happened to stumble upon Gehrig's memoirs in a series of columns in the Oakland Tribune, and I realized at the time it was rather special. I didn't realize how special it was until I did some background research and started to put the book together.
I mean, you're being modest, Alan. This is a remarkable find. This is the kind of thing a scholar such as yourself, and you are a historian, you dream of stumbling upon something like this. How did it happen?
Well, that's exactly what I did. I was researching a book that was published in 2005 on World War I. In the process, I found two members of the Lost Battalion, the unit that I described, ran into trouble during the Prohibition era. And I was going to do an article background of both men, as well as bookending an article about them. So that's what I was doing research on when I happened to stumble upon Lou Gehrig's columns. And it was like, wow. The first thing I did, I ignored the article I was starting to work on, and I found all the columns and read through them and was just amazed, like everyone else is now, that gets a chance to read through them.
What does Gehrig tell us about his life up to this point in these columns that have now been compiled in the book, which you are the editor of and which you contribute a biographical essay to? Again, it's Lou Gehrig, The Lost Memoir. What does he tell us about himself that we didn't know?
Well, he begins with his childhood as a self-described fat kid who was bullied by his peers. Also, because he didn't speak English until he went to school at the age of five.
Grew up in a German neighborhood on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, Yorkville,
yeah. And it continues on from his childhood on through his days at Commerce High School in New York City, his days at Columbia University, on to being a Yankee temporarily until he's sent back to the minor leagues at Hartford for a couple years. Then he becomes a real-life, full-fledged Yankee in 1925 and continues on through the World Series of 1927.
When we think about Gehrig now, of course, we think about his tremendous achievements as a player, arguably one of the five or six greatest baseball players of all time, the remarkable numbers that he amassed batting behind Babe Ruth in the Yankees lineup for a number of years, as you say, starting in 1925. And we think about the circumstances, of course, of his demise and the disease which is now named for him, ALS. Why does Gehrig continue to occupy such a large part of the American consciousness?
It was because he was such a unique individual. He was shy. He was modest. He shunned crowds. He didn't want publicity. Totally the opposite of a lot of stars in sports today.
Of Babe Ruth, for instance, his teammate.
Oh, my God. Babe Ruth lived for the spotlight in anything he did. He was an expert at baseball, womanizing, drinking, eating, swearing, belching, you name it. He wanted to be the best at everything that he did in his life. Lou was just the opposite. As a matter of fact, I think Lou was rather amused at all the antics that Babe had gone through in the time that the two men were together?
They're about, I guess they're 9 years apart in age, 9 or 10, depending on whether you accept 1894, 1895 is Babe Ruth's birth year. I think most people now accept 1894, and Gehrig was born in 1903. By the time Gehrig gets to the Yankees as a regular, by the time he becomes a regular, I should say, 1925, famously replacing Wally Pipp in the lineup, Babe Ruth has been the best player in baseball for half a decade. What was that relationship like?
I think the best way to describe it is Babe Ruth became Lou's big brother. When he first broke in with the Yankees, he was just another kid that was going to try and make the team. And after he was sent to the minors, Babe Ruth kind of dismissed him until he became a regular in 1925, like we discussed. And then he began to help him with his hitting. One of the things he was famous for was telling Gehrig, hit home runs in right field. You don't need to hit long flies to left and center. Put your power into pulling the ball and hit home runs like I do.
The short porch at Yankee Stadium in right field, only about 290 feet, is that right, at that time?
It was friendly, that's for sure.
It was friendly. We're speaking to the historian Alan Gaff about the new book, Lou Gehrig, The Lost Memoir, which is the product of his archival find. These columns that Gehrig wrote when he was still a very young player that were syndicated. Well, as a scholar, as someone who unearthed these columns, Alan, you know, what was the protocol like in those days when such stories would appear under the bylines of athletes themselves in newspapers? How much involvement did they have? It wasn't Lou, obviously, at a typewriter typing it himself.
In most cases, there were ghost writers for the famous stars, but Lou had 2 years of college, so he was an educated man in comparison with a lot of the ballplayers of his era. And in my opinion, I believe Lou wrote the first part of his memoir and had help from Ford Frick when it came time to do the World Series columns, because the World Series columns were very time sensitive. If they weren't filed the day after the game, before the next game, they were out of date and totally useless for a newspaper. We've tried to do some comparisons of language in Lou's memoir as opposed to other things that we know were ghostwritten, but unfortunately that's come up as inconclusive in the computer test. So we aren't able to say exactly for sure that Lou wrote the first part of his memoir, but I am convinced that he did.
And, of course, Ford Frick, who is best remembered today as the future president or commissioner of baseball, who all but affixed an asterisk to Roger Maris's record in 1961 when he broke Babe Ruth's 60 home runs in 162 games as opposed to 154 games. Frick, who had been a very close friend of Babe Ruth's and his ghostwriter as well, was at that time in the 20s still writing himself, a newspaper man. That's interesting. I assume that Gehrig might be doing what the other stars did, which was, you know, dictating some thoughts, having them expanded upon, elaborated upon, in some cases, of course, wholly fabricated by sports writers at the time. What makes you think Gehrig was doing this himself?
One of the things that comes through in everything that Lou did personally was his trademark humility, which is best exemplified by his speech at Yankee Stadium on his retirement. He exudes that in the first part of the memoir, and he has a unique style. I think the style in the memoir as opposed to the World Series columns are different enough that you could tell the difference. But I think the big thing was when he signed the contract, he agreed to do daily columns. As the season progressed in August and September, he realized that's not working out well. So it came from a daily column to three times a week, and then it became sporadic. If he had employed a ghostwriter, that ghostwriter would have been sure to have everything done on a timeline where he would get paid right away.
And this is about 1927. This is about Murderers Row, the most famous team ever assembled in baseball. A team that for a long time, 27 years, held the record for most regular season wins in the American League, and is still considered today arguably the greatest team of all time. How did Lou Gehrig fit into this team, the great Murderers Row Yankees of 27, which weren't just Ruth and Gehrig, but also Lazzeri and Coombs and Musil, and the great pitching staff? How did he fit in as a teammate?
Well, I think nowadays when people refer to the 1927 Yankees, the first thing they think of or mention is Babe Ruth and his 60 home runs. But if you look at the statistics, over the course of the year, Lou Gehrig had significantly more bases total than Ruth did, which is fantastic considering the fact that those 60 home runs came immediately before he came to bat. Lou's statistics, I believe, in 1927 entitled him to the 1927 American League Most Valuable Player Award, just for that reason, if nothing else. It certainly wasn't his base running or his fielding. He was never very adept at either. If it hadn't been for his hitting, I don't think he would be more than just an average ball player from that era, but his hitting is what made him an outstanding person.
Just incredible, incredible hitter, of course, and someone, because of the tragedy of his story and the depiction on film, Gary Cooper, of course, as Lou Gehrig in Pride of the Yankees, he continues to endure in the history of the pastime and beyond. The new book is Lou Gehrig, The Lost Memoir. It really is a remarkable find, and the man who found it was Alan D. Gaff. Alan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for what's the right word, I guess, for finding this book and putting it together in the form that we now have it in.
Well, thank you. I should mention that when I started this project, I was always referring to Lou Gehrig. By the time I was done, he was just plain Lou.
I'm Jeremy Schapp, and you can listen to new editions of The Sporting Life every Saturday and Sunday morning on ESPN Radio and the ESPN app, beginning at 6 a.m. Eastern Time.